But if Tracy's having trouble recording, I guess that means we can say whatever we want in the channel. Oh, never mind. Oh. Sam's recording.
Oh, I can record. Okay. I'm saying I can record, but I'll only be here for about 5 minutes. So.
Hi, Sam. You're going to do one of your come on in and run.
I told you. You want to start recording? You know, we've been chatting for, 45 minutes and 33 seconds. And then you decide, hey, let's do a roundtable 5 minutes ago. You know, well, I'm sorry. My wife just got home. I haven't seen her all day.
Whatever.
Does Jeff show up at the game table and like, okay, I got all this stuff, guys. And then like 10 minutes later, oh, man, I got to go.
Actually, I'll have you know, I'm the DM and the game is at my house. So there's
which
no
makes it
away.
Really off. That makes it really awkward, though, right? No, I'm kidding, of course. But
Sam better be recording right now. Okay, good.
Yeah, he is. He just can't talk in the channel.
Yeah, or which is actually even more fun because we can respond to Sam, and he can write things in the chat window, and then we can respond to it, and it'll be like he's here, but nobody has to hear his voice. I mean, gets to hear his voice.
Right.
Sam, feel better soon.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So, Tracy.
Yes.
Did you play a Shardalon?
I did not.
Okay, next topic.
You've derailed the entire conversation with just that, Tracy.
I was so excited to hear you talk about what a Shardalon was like.
Oh, I didn't get to play that one. I played Castle Ravenloft again. And we won again.
I still haven't played that. I'm such a loser.
Ravenloft is cool, and that's why both my wife and I are really looking forward to a Shardalon because we like Ravenloft. It's a fun. I'm hoping that they did a little bit of better balance with it though, because one thing we found is when it's just two players, a lot of the missions are just too hard. Like anything that has a boss is don't scale real well.
Oh, really? Because I have yet to be challenged in the game, and I'm playing with a 5-year-old.
Kidding, really? You and a 5-year-old?
Me and a 5-year-old, and we haven't lost a single mission yet.
Have you done like the Dracolich mission and stuff?
That's the next one. We're going in order, and that's the next one on the list.
Huh.
Apparently, yeah. That's a secret. You got to play with a 5-year-old.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. Does the 5-year-old's eyes glow in eerie blue when you play with her? I mean, or him, or I son or whoever, him. So you know, if that's the case, you know, maybe there's a reason, but.
Anyway, there's a lot of like loose parts in the rules.
Yeah,
it feels like they move anywhere, you know, move onto the tile, and I guess they can start in any square, and you can kind of cheat and say like, well, I guess I'll move them over here. Rand's not going to hurt me as bad.
Yeah, which you do all the time. I mean, you kind of have to take advantage of those sorts
of. We were having a really hard time, so I don't know.
Maybe I'm doing it wrong. I had one goal time so far.
Yeah,
Sam says I'm doing it wrong, which is possible. I know that, I mean, every time I played for the first, like, 3 or 4 missions, we discovered a new part of the rules or figured out we're doing something wrong or whatever. So there was a learning curve in there. But I feel like I've got the rules down pretty well in the last several missions.
You're playing it where as soon as the monster shows up, they get to attack you?
Uh-huh, right. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know what I'm doing. Anyway, I'm looking forward to our Shardalon. I think it'll be cool.
Yeah, I think it will be too.
If anything, it's got a lot of cool minis. It's got a lot of rare minis.
Now, the other day on Twitter, Chris Premis, who's the head honcho over at Green Ronin, was criticizing the choice of using a Shardalon of all creatures as the focal point of this. Because, like, you know, who's ever heard of a Shardalon before?
I haven't.
I haven't.
I haven't.
And I've been playing a long time, so I've never
heard of him. He was the focus of the 3E module series, wasn't he, if I remember right? A Shardalon?
I don't know.
Sure, that sounds okay to me. I'll believe you because I've never heard of him either. I was gonna have the Wikipedia.
My dog is chewing on a bone upstairs, and it's so loud that it's vibrating the entire ceiling.
Good grief!
Yeah,
is it like a mastodon bone or something?
Yeah, it really is. He's a strong chewer, according to the descriptions.
But Frequent Beef ran us through Castle Ravenloft when we were at BDXP.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's a big box.
Yeah.
Legion of Gold.
Yeah. I haven't read a lot of it yet.
You have a picture on Twitter of you reading it.
I know, it looks cool so far, but I fell asleep.
You're like, here's a picture of me holding it. I'm very tired.
I brought it to bed, and then I fell asleep. And I don't think there are many. I think there are as many additional player options in particular one on like Feminine Cargo, but I'm not entirely sure about that. That was just
there's eight or something.
Yeah, I thought there was more in Feminine Cargo.
Yeah, there's 20 in the other ones.
Yeah. But I like it. And the monsters are level. Like, there's a lot that's 10. Where the other books are.
Is anybody coming in clearly? Because I'm here. I'm hearing the audio get all funky.
Everyone's kind of breaking.
Okay.
Yeah, we got a crazy Max Headroom thing going on.
Who's hosting the call?
I am.
Tracy.
Okay.
We can try.
Girly girl.
Okay, let me clue for them.
Wow, our audio quality just went in the toilet.
Is it any better now?
It's a little bit better, but it's clearly on the, you know, high bandwidth, low bandwidth.
Yeah. Although the problem looks like it's fading.
Yeah.
If you watch Skype's technical call info, usually when the jitter gets really high, that's when you start having problems, and it's getting down to normal again. So.
Okay. Cool. Might have been tweaked.
It's interesting. It looks like the contents for Ashardalon are exactly the same as the contents for Ravenloft. I mean, the exact number of things.
Yeah. That makes sense, yeah.
I guess, yeah. And I hope the characters are different. I heard that the characters are kind of the same.
No, I heard that they're completely different except for the only overlap in terms of either race or class is there's an elf in Ashardalon. I think it's an elf paladin, but that's the only overlap at all.
Really?
From what I understand, everything else is supposed to be completely different. I mean, I could be wrong. I mean, this is all secondhand.
Well, it says fighter and rogue, but I guess they're just different race class combinations.
It could be.
Hopefully different powers, too.
Yeah. Huh.
Now, what's this I understand about there's going to be a legend of Dritz later on, too?
Yeah, what's that about?
Fuck. Yeah.
Tell us, Tracy.
That's about all I know about it.
Okay.
That's all I've heard.
Yeah, they didn't give a lot of details about those products, just that they were coming.
Although
I don't think there's a picture.
Was it here on our previous roundtable that people were talking about the Narath game and wondering if that was another thing? Because they talked about that at Gen Con. Was that on the roundtable that people were wondering what that was?
That we were wondering about what
that I was on.
Oh yeah, I think I brought it up. The board game,
Conquest of Narath. Yeah.
Yeah.
Talked about it a little bit. I think.
Right. I think we figured it out.
Yeah. At Gen Con, they sort of described it as D&D meets, I think, Risk or Axis and Allies or whatever it was.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like to me too. Which might be cool for just the minis. Exactly. I mean.
Although it might be a fun way to do like a big battle in your. In your game.
Yeah.
We're driving Sam crazy.
He's like, yeah, I know the answer to these questions and I can't say them because I'm sick. Feel better. you guys heard about the way they're reorganizing their releases.
So, share it.
Okay. Yeah. Basically, they're going to organize them around the encounter seasons. So the products that are coming out are going to tie into encounters. And they're really trying not to push out products that don't tie into the theme for that particular release cycle, unless there's a really good reason to.
Does it seem like they're putting a whole lot into encounters?
Yes. Agreed.
I mean, I have a place close by, but I'm still not going to drive out there on Wednesday. I have traffic.
But I think it's helping to get new players in.
But, yeah,
and I think they've had a lot more success with encounters than they expected to.
Yeah,
and they've decided to start monopolizing on that. It's like, oh, we got a lot more people playing than we expected. Let's use that to drive the rest of the brand.
I mean, it's probably sacrilege, but I would love for them to replace LFR with something else. And you know, if Wizards did some kind of sponsored LFR thing that's like encounters that I could do on the weekend, I'd be all over it. But
see, I run my regular home game, you know.
LFR was a sponsored LFR thing.
I know, but I mean, now it just feels like it's mired. It's just mired in bureaucracy.
I don't want to slag encounters. I mean, even though it's not my thing, but I do wish there was more flexibility. I do wish it were more like you're saying, Mike, that you could run it any day of the week, on the weekends, whatever, and just have something more like that going on. Then you must come to your game store on Wednesday if you plan to participate, because I don't want to go to my game store on Wednesday. I'd rather go on the weekends.
Right. It takes me 45 minutes to get out there and back. I'll tell you what, I went to Encounters once, and it was because our regular game was canceled. And I drove 45 minutes out there. My character died in the first round, and then I drove 45 minutes home. You know.
So what about LFR are you unhappy with?
Me or anybody?
Anybody, particularly you.
So, I mean, I like it. I play in it. Michelle and I, my wife and I, have both played in it for, you know, a couple of years. I mean, the DMs are hit or miss, but that's probably true anywhere. You know, some DMs are really, really good, and some of them are, you know, kind of, they're very rigid to the rules, and they're very rigid to the mod, and they blame the mod for all the problems that the game is having. I think that there's kind of a perception that, you know, I'll tell you one big problem is they call the guys judges instead of DMs, which immediately puts this kind of competitive, you know, I have to run you through a set scenario and then I can't fudge it just to make the game fun anymore.
Right.
So,
I know they're working on that. They're trying to find ways to, cause there is like this, belief amongst a lot of the DMs or judges and among LFR players that you have to play the module according to what it's written. It's not, you know, this is so different from your home game sort of thing.
Right, but it doesn't need to be. I mean, I ran one the other day and I got them. And the other thing is the mods are kind of hit or miss. There's a ton of mods and some of them are okay and some of them are not. And I got one that was really, really like story heavy and not a lot of encounters. And I kind of like to focus on the encounters. So I kind of rebuilt it into one that still had a lot of the story elements, but it was a little bit more streamlined in how it could run. And, you know, and nobody cared. Like nobody, you know, people at the table had played it another way and they're like, well, at least it was different this time. Like, so nobody cares. And now nothing is being even recorded, you know, like you are solely responsible for keeping track of your character. There's no record anywhere. And there wasn't really a record before, but everybody kind of pretended there was.
Right.
Which meant that everybody had to fill out a bunch of forms and everybody had to, you know, there's a bunch of paperwork. And you're like, why is there paperwork to play D&D? So, you know, so anyway, but, and then the other thing is like, you're kind of expected to get your own maps together and you're expected to, you know, have all the minis that you need and you might not. And some people just do wet erase and some people use dungeon tiles, but a lot of the adventurers don't necessarily use dungeon tiles. So, so the materials are kind of hard to get. And that's, you know, with encounters, they get a box and the box has everything you need to play. And I'd kind of like to see more stuff like that.
Okay. Do you want to say something, Jeff? Reiner?
I can. I tend to not be a fan of LFR because my experience is that the play tends to focus more on the mechanics and less on the roleplay.
Okay.
And I like a nice quiet place like my house to play my games, and being forced into a public location isn't ideal for me.
Yeah, it's funny because I actually, you know, I like the mechanics more than the role play sometimes. Depends on how it's going. But I also like the community. I mean, one thing I will say, and I don't want to bash it too hard, because like I was saying earlier, I live in the Mecca for D&D here. You know, I mean, the Washington, D.C. area seems to have everybody around here. And, you know, Vic and Rob, the two guys that run the LFR games here, are just, you know, monuments to patience and organization. And they manage at least once a month, usually 2 to 3 times a month, to run games in 3 different stores across the DC area at the same time with, you know, hundreds of people. And it's really awesome. And they're really awesome guys and we're having a great time with them. So my complaints really are not for that. It's for the larger structure of, you know, of LFR.
Okay. Now I have a question that's not related to LFR.
Okay.
Sam is recording this, but he's not there, although something just came through his mic. And is he the one where if I hang up, it's going to stop recording and nothing else is going to happen?
It's possible. It's been known to happen.
Okay. Okay. Because I need to go.
It doesn't happen all the time. It's recordings.
Like here. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Are we back?
Yep.
The one thing I did want to say is that I've got the last of the DD.
And we just lost Jeff.
No.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Well, I'm back.
Well, I have to admit that in the long time since I've been playing D&D, organized play is not something I've ever really participated in.
Yeah.
So I just... I run my own games. I've always been able to find players, and so I've never. I think it's a great program for players that don't have a game and have got a good local gaming store that they can go hang out at. But yeah, I always feel kind of awkward when the subject comes up because it's like, yeah, they're putting a lot of energy to this. It's totally a piece that's just not part of my experience. So
I'm always kind of looking. There's a great book called Rework, which is done by the guys who did 37 Signals. And one of the things they talk about in this book is the idea of byproducts, that whenever you're making a main product, you should be thinking about the things that are around it that you can also sell and that also help people. And I look at like all the material they're putting together for the encounter stuff. And I'm like, why are they not selling this? You know, like I'd buy it.
Yeah.
You know, selling prepackaged adventures that had all the tokens and all the maps and everything for, you know, these seasons, put them in a book and sell them.
Right.
So, you know, and I don't think they want to because I think they're afraid that, you know, people like me will specifically avoid encounters because I know I'll get to play at some other time. But you think like a year later, you know, they could do that.
Well, and I don't know if they can sell it. It also maybe depends on how the contracts were written when it originally came out.
But it's all their stuff. I can't imagine who do they have a contract with?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if they want to sell it.
Unless there's some kind of weird arrangement with their distributors. Because who's handling all the materials. It's not Wizards directly. It's the distributors that bring the products to the game stores.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Like the game stores would be mad. But the game stores depend on them. The game stores don't have any hand in the fight. Like they're not gonna stop selling D&D stuff.
Well, no, yeah, exactly.
So I don't know. I get Wizards really feels like the way that their game is gonna hold it, and maybe that's it. Maybe they feel like, look, we tried to go mass market, and mass market doesn't really work. So what we're trying to do is make sure we hold on to the hobbyist base. But you know, I can't imagine.
There's also the question that even if they're not going to sell the exact things that they've done for encounters, why don't they do adventure modules presented in the same fashion? I mean, not the right. Encounters ones, but different ones, new ones, brand new ones, all just designed to be sold.
We would, of course, be, you know, heathens if we did not mention Home Encounters.
Which got mentioned at DDXP, at least in the first product seminar.
Mm-hmm. Which is a community-driven home, D&D encounters for people that play at home that... Newbie DM and Game Fiend and who else is involved in it? Dice Monkey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mark from Dice Monkey all put together, and it's pretty interesting.
I think that's a great program too, but again, I feel awkward when the subject comes up because I totally support them, but I have no use for the material, and I think they're writing great stuff. It's good stuff. I just can't use it because it's not mine. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing an encounters type program, so.
Yeah. I mean, I've played the first encounter. It was enjoyable, but it was just never something that I was planning on doing the whole time anyway. It was
for encounters or for home encounters?
Well, I played the first season of regular encounters.
Right.
And I played the first encounter of home encounters.
Right.
And I can see why they're popular. I can see why people would get use out of them, but it's just... it's not something I would ever be terribly interested in long term, either as a player or a GM.
Because you're what you're really looking for is a regular D&D game.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that's kind of the way I feel too. Like, if I'm going to gather everybody at my house, I'm not going to run one encounter.
Yeah, I think that's what home encounters is running into, at least in part, is because when you just do one encounter, even if it's bookended by role play, or you have role play during the encounter, it doesn't feel very satisfying in terms of game length. I mean, because that's what, an hour and a half. Yeah. I mean, if you have a really long encounter, maybe 2 hours, and that, at least to me, it doesn't feel like a terribly satisfying session if it's done that early. I want something more like, you know, 3 or 4 hours.
See, our group wouldn't be able to do 3 or 4 hours with our schedules. So we do the shorter schedules during the week usually.
Yeah, we usually have about 3 hours on a Wednesday night. That's what we do. And we try to get 2 to 3 encounters done. We're pretty good about it.
Yeah, I budget 3 or 4. If we go less, that's fine. Usually that's fine, but I like to have it at least set aside just in case we do go long.
So I have I sent a tweet out to my army of Twitter followers about any questions that they had for the show. Do we want to talk about those, or do we want to save that for the end?
We can do them now. Whichever. We could change.
Well, I mean, do we have any other main topics we want to, you know, hit besides Ravenloft and?
Tracy, did you get any secret information about what happened with Ravenloft?
The
campaign book that they were supposed to put out?
I think what they said at the first product seminar was just that it wasn't where they wanted it to be. And so it was better because it didn't fit in with those seasons of encounters and with the themes that they had going on. It sounded like it was better for them not to put it out. That's the impression I got from the seminar.
Yeah, it was kind of surprising because that was kind of their cornerstone announcement at Gen Con last year.
Right.
And then now they're kind of saying, well, no, Nentir Vale is the new campaign book that we're putting out this year. But they didn't really talk about that.
Well, wait, Nentir Vale?
I'm sorry.
No, it's Neverwinter Night.
Neverwinter Night, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's because it's the movie. It's video games coming out. And then
there's
the D&D movie that's coming up too.
Yeah. Seem to be tying everything together.
Yeah, and I think they're just trying to build on... I mean, my thought from everything I heard was that they're trying to build a cohesive PR plan. I mean, it was kind of crazy that Dark Sun comes out, and then right afterwards Central comes out, and everyone stops talking about Dark Sun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I haven't even started.
where this really lets them, market what's going on for the next year.
Right.
In a way that makes sense to, I think, like, particularly people like us who talk a lot about D&D products, and to even just the, you know, people who are buying the stuff in the stores.
Right. Did you get a chance to play the Shadowfell box set?
I did see some stuff from it.
Did you see the cards and whatnot?
The Despair deck?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw the Despair deck. That was pretty cool. Yeah, it's because, there are a lot of them have penalties, and then after you get through and you work through the penalty, you can get a boon. Not all the cards have boons. It depends on what the penalty was to begin with. But I thought that was really cool, and they try to tie it a lot more into role-playing and give reasons for players to role-play rather than just strict mechanics.
That's good.
Do those cards make the assumption that you're actually on the Shadowfell when those events take place? That are on the cards?
I only briefly saw them. I didn't get into that level of thinking. But they're meant, so part of it is meant, because this is a spare deck and it's Shadowfell, to give you this feeling like you don't do it right away and then you kind of like go crazy sort of thing. So it's meant to build that sort of feeling.
Okay.
What else? There was something else that came out.
Or
that's coming out.
They had a lot of the fortune cards there.
What'd you think of that?
So, basically, I didn't get to use the fortune cards that well. I played a lot of casters, and I kept getting the cards that like gave you a bonus if you charged. I was like, there's no way that a -1 that I'm gonna charge. At near the end of the convention, I ran a game, and the people finally had enough where they were really building their own decks. And I did see some change to the game, but it wasn't like any, it wasn't really like they were overpowered or that any particular character was more overpowered compared to another. But I did notice where they did come in and a couple of times, wait, my monster's a little quicker than I thought they were going to. And I think partly it was that the people who were doing it knew how to build decks and they knew how to use, you know, they remembered to turn the card over. I kept forgetting to turn my card over. I know one of the rules that they're probably going to change right away is currently you turn the card over at the start of your turn. Makes a lot more sense to do it at the end. That way you can, you know, spend time thinking about what your turn's going to be rather than potentially having your plan wiped away because, of, you know, you get a fortune card and it's like, oh, I want to use this instead. And then the other thing they're really pushing were, you know, trying to think of alternative uses. So, like, at my table, when we were talking about them at the end, one person said that it might be cool to put one or maybe a couple out in the middle of the table, and those were the ones for that encounter. And monsters and PCs got to use them. And I thought that was a pretty cool idea, too. But I don't think they're crazy overpowering or anything like that.
No, I mean, the thing that kind of turned me off on them is that I have enough complications at the table and I don't really need anything else.
Right.
Yeah, that's
where I sit as well.
It's alien to me that when I hear people playing D&D and they talk about building decks.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think it's a little strange. I don't. It's fine. I mean, I don't. I'm not one of these guys that's going to jump on and say, "Oh my God, it's a card game now."
Right.
You know, I'm not gonna do that. But I think I'm with Mike and Aaron in that it's I've got enough to manage, man. It's like I'm not doing anymore.
Yeah. Although
I suppose if all of my players came to me and said, "Wow, we heard about the," and they're not real connected, and so they don't necessarily jump in on stuff like this. But if they all came to me and said, "Oh, we love these fortune cards, we want to use them," then I would say, okay, let's see how we can work them in. But they haven't done that, and I'm not going to go pursue it. So
I think they help a lot more with Essentials melee characters.
I could see that.
Yeah, sure.
Why does it give them something other than a freaking melee basic?
Well, I mean, it gives you something that you can do. And then also the Revenge of Kal-El game I played in had some of the shadow stuff in it, and that was really cool, too.
I hope they make that. That's another one where I was like, why won't they put that out? You know, why are they only doing that at conventions? I want to play it.
Yeah.
But, well, see, I wanted the fourth edition version of the original Tomb of Wars.
We got it.
And it was, and it's
two different versions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I thought the original wasn't.
Well, the one you could buy wasn't the original.
Yeah, so there's a DM. There was a DM reward one.
Right, and that's the one. Yeah, I would have.
And that's an actual redo. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'd like to buy that, and I can't get it because it was
right. Right. Yeah, why won't they sell it? I could see like they put it out a year earlier, and then they sell it later. You know, that would make sense.
Sure, after the season.
Why wouldn't you sell it? Right. Why wouldn't you sell it eventually? Why would you just then stop making it if it's not that? Assuming it's not that expensive to make.
Maybe a year.
I have a question. I have an essentials question. I have a question for Tracy, but I think everyone's got an opinion about it. Greg Bilsland said, and I heard this a couple of times in the seminars, thanks to the great Jeff Greiner, I was able to listen to the seminars, you know, a day or two after they had occurred, and that was awesome.
On thetomeshow.com.
Thetomeshow.com, of which you are what is your role there now? Executive producer?
I am owner.
Executive producer?
I'm a co-host. I don't know. Whatever he wants to throw my way, I guess I am responsible for.
That's very cool. Congratulations on that role. It's a great show.
Yeah, being.
And not just because I'm on it a lot.
I've never been on the Tome Show.
No, I've been on once.
So I'm very, I stick my foot in a lot of doors. Hey, what's going on, guys? Can I get in? So Greg Bilsland said that his Dark Sun game, and I was actually surprised when he had this up on his blog, and I tweeted him about it. Mm-hmm. His Dark Sun game is Essentials only.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And, yeah, and he said that he switched to that, and this came up during the DM tip thing, that he switched to Essentials only because of speed, that he wanted to have a faster game. What did you think about that?
I don't know. I mean, it wouldn't be faster for me because I'd be spending all my time trying to figure out what else I can do. Oh, I totally, I made him, so we were playing this game and the archer was on this boat and I was like, okay, so what do I have to do to jump from boat to boat to get to the archer? And then I fell in the water and I made him tell me how I could overturn the little boat that the archer was on. So I made him work for his DM. I don't know. I mean, I think essentials can make things faster because you don't have as many options. I think essentials works better with the themes.
What themes?
In general, with character themes.
Like how? Like what do you mean?
Because because themes add additional powers. So if you've already cut back on the number of powers that a lot of the classes have, and then you add the theme powers back in, it's not as bad as when.
You mean the dark sun themes?
Dark sun themes, yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, and you get that a little extra psionic freebie power too.
Right.
Yeah, I'm going to be running in this dark sun game, and I'm eliminating all the PS or the PHB 1 classes from it. And
that'll be interesting.
And switching to just Dark Sun classes. Well, the thing is, it kills the Warlord because there's no Essentials Warlord, and the Warlord is a great Dark Sun class. So I'm kind of miffed about that. And the other thing is that the Arena Fighter, I still have to use some PHB 1 stuff if people want to use the Arena Fighter. You know, I can house rule that they have to use Arena Fighter powers whenever possible, but they still get a couple of PHB 1 things. But other than that, I kind of like getting rid of the PHB 1.
Gonna get rid of my rogue. Sarah Dark Magic is no more.
Yeah. I tell you, the new rogue is pretty fun. Or at least I liked it a lot. I played a ninth to eleventh level Essentials Thief, and he was hardcore. He was doing just insane amounts of damage.
I know, that's the thing. I mean, I know I like playing strikers and strikers are about damage, but the damage is kind of secondary to me. I liked having those few push powers. But so what we did was Chris Perkins helped me negotiate a push power in into my thief.
Right.
That was awesome. We negotiated.
I like essentials because that's what I'm using to skin for Star Frontiers.
So. Oh, nice.
Yeah. Because of the, it's just simpler and there's less, you know, there's less to mess with, and I think it's easier to break it down from there to try to skin it than to try to take the whole 4E rule set and do the same thing. So, but.
So, Mike, you're going away?
I'm just taking a quick break. I got to let the dog out and get some ice cream.
So, what else? What did I miss during the weekend?
What did you miss?
Was there anything you missed? I don't think you really missed that much because I think everybody was talking about what was going on where you were at.
Yeah.
Oh, special thanks to you for tweeting all that stuff, though, because I was, like, totally following your tweets on what was going on, and it was between you and Baldwin Games, was it? Yeah. It was like, it was like I was at DDXP, but without all the cool personal interactions.
Yeah. Dustin did a great job also tweeting and doing the, I thought he did some other stuff. And then Critical Hits did some stuff too.
Dire Flail.
Yeah.
He did at least one that I remember watching.
Yeah. It's really hard to keep up typing with Chris Perkins talking, by the way.
Well, I'm sure it is.
Yeah. I think almost everybody mentioned that at some point, that it was hard to keep up with them.
And I only had my iPhone. I didn't have my netbook on me because I wasn't planning on it. I was just there to listen. And then I noticed, you know, that Dave Tucker couldn't make it to the event. And he usually does that stuff. So I was like, you know, let me jump on and do it so that people can get it. But adding the DDXP hashtag would have just taken too many letters, so I just did D&D. I hope people weren't upset that I spam so much. But
I doubt it was that big a problem. I had live tweeting coming in from God knows how many people, so and if it didn't bother me, I don't think it would have bothered anybody else.
Yeah. I was just glad it was a slow day at work that day, so it was like, I'm just going to watch my Twitter feed right now. So, but. No, it sure makes me anxious for Gen Con, though. I'm looking forward to Gen Con even more now. So
yeah, I'm looking forward to Gen Con, too. This will be my first one this year.
Oh, wow.
I've been to other conventions, but I've never been to I've never been to any specifically tabletop convention. I've been to gaming conventions, but that was mostly video games. Mm-hmm. I've been to anime, comics, and all that other stuff, but never tabletop, and let alone Gen Con. So yeah. I'm really looking forward to going this year. This I just need to get the hotel figured out.
Yeah, we haven't done any of that yet, but I've got... I mean, it used to be that you didn't register until April, and so I'm not too worried about it. I mean, I just got to get the funds in so we can do it, so... But I'm not worried about not getting. I better make it this year. I'm on a panel, apparently, maybe even two of them. So, and my wife is doing spouse events. So,
nice.
And I thought that was really cool. So it was like, wow, cool. How'd you do that? So, but yes, she just came. I need to post a picture of it. But she's doing these felted like monster things, little felted monsters that you can make.
Oh, nice.
And they're cute. They're really adorable. So I'll have to take some pictures and post them up there. She's working on designs now and figuring out what her supplies are going to cost and stuff. So, but yeah, that'd be a fun Gen Con. I'm looking forward to meeting people.
Right.
Yeah, that's mostly what I'm looking forward to. I mean, I've known all you guys for like over a year now in some cases, and mm-hmm. haven't. The only person that I know from Twitter that I've met has been, Mike Robles. And that's it.
Right.
Wow. Yeah, I've not met anyone that I talked to on Twitter at all. So
one of the other interesting things, when the Revenge of Kal-El, they did some really in-depth character stories with that adventure. I haven't played in a D&D classic adventure before, so I don't know if that's something they commonly do. But it was interesting because it changed some of the... normal 4E stuff. Like, you weren't all necessarily in the same group already when you started the adventure and stuff like that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And they
were there any... Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, they gave player motivations, and it wasn't necessarily the group's motivation as a whole. It was individual players had their own... Individual characters had their own motivations.
Were there any contested events? I mean, in other words... what's the word I want to use? Like timed adventures where you try to see how far you get through.
I don't think they had any of those.
I'm trying to remember what was those used to be called? Tournament events. That's what I was trying to think of. Tournament events.
Yeah, I don't recall seeing any of them on the schedule.
Okay. I was just curious.
They did the Battle Interactive, which is really interesting. That's basically... You have all these tables of people playing the same adventure, and how the different tables interact determines how things overall are going. So I guess your table could volunteer to go do a special mission that could determine how other parts of the adventure went. I didn't play in it, but that's what I gathered from listening to what other people had been saying about it. And then they had Ashes of Athas, which is a new, I think it's considered a living campaign, being done by, you know, basically Baldwin Games Group and people like that. Chris Sims, Matt James, forgetting the third person, Chad something, I think. And they wrote adventures for that. And that wasn't, you know, that's something separate.
Sounds like there was a lot of cool stuff going on, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I wish I'd been there, but...
Next year, Mike.
Yep. I'll be there next year. I'll figure it out.
You can steal all my thunder. So
we're going to do some Twitter questions. I got some really good Twitter questions.
Okay.
Sure. Let's do it.
All right. So I'm going to do them in reverse order. So those people who, well, no, I'll be mean. So I'll do them from like the first people. I'm going to skip Thaddeus asking, why is Thaddeus so awesome?
He's not, right, but okay.
Yeah, right. The question itself is broken.
I challenge the premise of the question. Assumes facts not in evidence.
I think he's pretty cute, but you know.
Let's see.
Poor Thaddeus.
There's a question for you. Did you what are some tips? So besides the stuff that was at the DM tips, the DM expert panel, what were some things that you learned about DMing just from being there? What were three things that you took home that you would use at your own, that you'd use at your own game that we wouldn't have heard through any of the other channels?
I honestly don't know of anything.
Nothing? You're so good.
I am so freaking awesome that no, because I didn't get to play in mini games. I played in three. And I didn't I learned a great thing to give players if you're having a game that's not so serious is to make them rhyme, and then they can get a bonus to their attack rolls. Mm-hmm. Because at least I totally went for that. And
somebody stole that. Did they play that? Did they do that for the Christmas game?
Yeah, that's what Mike Rolis did.
Yeah, he stole that from me. Well, I don't know if he stole from me, but I did the exact same thing when I ran that game back January.
Yeah, yeah. No, if we did a rhyme, we got a bonus to our attack roll, and I did that all the time as Twitter knows. they weren't great rhymes, but mm-hmm. It's always fun to go let your players go for it.
Right.
It's apparently a moderate check to overturn a rowboat.
So wait. There once was an orc from Nantucket whose sword was so long. No.
No.
Somebody did do a riff on that one. I did not.
Did they?
I did not. Mine were much worse. So the one thing I kept doing, and it worked really well for my groups, was that I had them, they weren't explaining how they were attacking stuff sometimes. So mm-hmm. I just had them do the death scenes, and after they started doing the death scenes when mm-hmm. they killed the creatures, they just started doing it for everything. And if you put in, I made sure that they knew that they could negotiate with me to do things like take over mechanical spiders or use rope against physics to get somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a lot of fun.
Cool.
My groups really enjoyed that. I had not had a chance to really use that information before, so the confirmation that it actually worked was great.
Right.
So
here's a question from Quack Tape.
Okay.
What changes would you make to create a more cloak and dagger / espionage game for like Eberron?
Anyone else want to take that one?
I can take it first. I've played a little bit in Eberron. I don't know if I would change much of anything. Eberron's kind of set up that way.
Yeah, but there's
a lot of.
Yeah.
I mean, if one of the things I would do is probably make sure that there was plenty of intrigue going on, several different storylines. I would try to drop red herrings along. What? Uh oh.
Sorry, you clipped that for a second. I think it was me.
Oh. But I'd drop red herrings along the way. I try to make sure that throughout the game there was a sense of foreboding, probably, with an espionage-type thing. And I think I want to say that E. Foley has run – I think her Eberron game sort of has a lot of those elements in it too. So mm-hmm. that would be a good source to go to.
Yeah, I have would to be ask her, about it.
Yeah, so.
I ran an Eberron game before 4th edition. I ran a 3.5 Eberron game, and one of the tricks that I did is I had three houses. And all three houses, the party could work for any of the three. I think the only villains that existed were the Emerald Claw, I think they were called.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the only real bad guys. But there were three other houses that were all trying to work for the same goal and against each other. But the party got to decide which one they were going to work with or how they would switch from one to the other. And kind of thinking about your NPCs and your you know, instead of having good guys and bad guys, you want to make sure that, well, sometimes your good guys are not really all that good and sometimes your bad guys aren't all that bad. Mm. And if you can kind of make make it as gray as possible, make the world as gray as possible instead of some very clear delineations between black and white. Dragon Age, of course. Dragon Age is such a great example for how to really add good choices and hard choices into a game. I think it's a great source. The video game, I never play the RPG. So, I mean, that's how I would do kind of a espionage-y cloak and dagger.
Yeah, I would agree. I would make the factions have a lot of stuff going on in the background, whether the PCs are directly involved or not, and just let the players pick and choose what parts they want to get into. I might restrict classes. I'm not sure that in a cloak and dagger espionage game you're going to necessarily have a paladin or a cleric walking around. or even maybe something like a barbarian. So I might at least think about what classes are more appropriate to that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't necessarily limit them, but it would be something that I consider. But yeah, I think Mike's exactly right. I think you need to make the intrigue. You make the factions there, and then let the players go to whatever depth that they want to. Obviously, sometimes you're going to need to have it come to them. But I think another key thing is to, if you're going to do something like that, I think you need to make sure all your players are on board first, because it can go really quickly from a cloak and dagger espionage game to a more standard D&D game if some of your players aren't interested in that, or they don't know that that's what you're working towards. It can really easily be derailed if not everybody is on the same page with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'd agree. Go ahead.
No, did you already answer? I don't remember.
Well, yeah, I did. I was just going to add something real quick, and that's that with Eberron, I think it's one of those campaign settings that if your players don't have a lot of character development, I think you're going to be at a disadvantage. I just think that the world is so richly complex with all the interplays of the different factions and things that your players really need to have a decent character background and development behind it, and clear goals and things that their characters want to do so that you can integrate those into the storyline. Otherwise, I think you're going to fall a little short, but that's, you know.
I think in the case of Eberron especially, I think that could really benefit from being specifically telling the players that you are part of this organization, whether it being the King's Lanterns or whatever the other countries' equivalents are, or even a Great House member themselves. I think it can really benefit if you give the players something to start with,
right,
and then have them get involved in the politics and the intrigue surrounding that faction.
Mm-hmm. All right, next question. So, Tracy, this is a good one for you, considering you just came back from, and it's a DDXP. This is from AFET, AFET underscore,
yep,
who asks, oh no, sorry, it's not from AFET. He was the one that asked about what you learned about DMing, not understanding that you've already absorbed all knowledge about
DMing. He was in my game.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. What'd you learn about him? Where was it? There was a great question. It was basically, I'll have to find out who asked the question, but the question was, what did you see made for a good con game? Like, what were some of the criteria for a good con game as opposed to a game you would do at a, you know, a part of a campaign? Like, what makes for a good one-shot game?
Oh, that's a hard question. I think it depends. Like, so I advertise my game slightly differently. People pretty much picked my game, I think, because they knew who I was and they knew what type of game I like to run. So mine was much more like a home game, I think. You want things... So one of the things to remember about being at a con is that most people are going to be tired. So subtlety is often lost. You probably want to hit them over the head with the clues.
Mm-hmm.
You want to... Pacing is important because you only have, you know, 4 or 5 hours to play. And you want to make sure you get in the big boss battle, so keeping an eye on the time and making sure you can cut.
Hello?
Hey. Hello?
So we lost Mike.
Yeah, that was weird.
Let's call him back.
Sorry.
Oh, no problem.
Was that just me?
I think it was just
no.
You.
Good. No, because I got booted too.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I think Skype dropped the call. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Because I saw you actually go offline and come back on, Tracy.
Oh, okay. Being able to, I had 3 to 5 players, so being able to scale it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm. That question was, by the way, from AFET. He asked multiple questions. Let's see, I'll pick another one here. For the big bad evil guy in a campaign, is it best to take something right out of the monster manual, create a PC to use, or some mixture of the two? What do you do when you're designing a big bad evil guy? I guess mechanically.
Somebody else want to do it?
Well, I suppose it depends on what your big bad evil guy is. I mean, there might be times where it's more appropriate to make basically a PC and cut down some of the options and use that as your big bad. I personally tend to go with starting with a monster manual creature and then altering it, you know, switching out powers, adjusting levels, whatever. But I can see you going either way depending on what the thrust of your campaign is. Like for the Eberron thing we were talking about earlier, the spies and intrigue, you might be better served with a PC class as your bad guy. But in other games, you might be better off with either something straight out of the Monster Manual or something that used to belong in the Monster Manual.
Randall?
I have actually used... Right now, I'm running prepared modules, so the bad guys are the bad guys that are in there. But when I go off from using prepared material, I often use like groups of creatures as the bad guys, and they don't see the main bad guy because he's either hidden or too well protected or whatever for the longest period of time. Like for example, I had a campaign where the Githyanki were the bad guys, and they would constantly come on these Githyankis, and they were doing this or that, and they would kill various units and things, but they would not. They'd never find them. He used to piss the hell out of them, but they would know that. I mean, someone's obviously sending them after them, but it wouldn't be until the very end that you would actually see. Well, yeah, there's this major lieutenant, or you know, serve or direct minion of the lich, you know, the lich queen or whatever that's actually, you know, running the show. But sometimes it's just groups of like one specific group that's constantly harassing them.
Tracy, do you have a thought?
I usually make my own because I want them to tie in really closely to the other monsters that I'm running in the field.
What do you use to build your own? Do you start with a base or do you just use the rules from DMG?
So I used to just pick something, often already an elite or a solo, and change it around. And now I do it from scratch because I've learned how to. But I just try to think about what I picture that big bad being like, you know, what type of power might they have? Are they a big strong guy? Are they going to be hurling fireballs?
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And then just try. And a lot of times I'll just look at other creatures' powers and then steal those and pick and choose. If I want to do it quickly, that's how I'll do it.
I think what I've seen in my games was that as soon as you put a big bad evil guy on the table, the group is going to just, you know, drop meteors on their head. Mm-hmm. And you need to design with that understanding. So I think, you know, a true big bad evil guy almost always has to be a solo. I think anything else will be killed too quickly. And they should be a solo that is really taking the place of an elite, you know, like there should be tons of other monsters in the battle as well as a solo so that it doesn't seem like, you know, they've got other things to deal with besides just that solo. If it's not a solo, or even if it is a solo, but your group is pretty tough. I've done a lot of like skill challenge-y things in the battle to protect the big bad evil guy. So I had a character who had a prismatic sphere, and the prismatic sphere had to be disrupted by, you know, six different elemental types before they could actually start doing damage to the guy. You know, you can have another one where you have a, you know, some kind of healing fonts that are healing them up. For Orcus, when I was running a 35th level version of Orcus, he had these four sacrifices, angelic sacrifices, and each one was giving him a major bit of protection. Like one of them was a huge amount of DR, one of them was healing, one of them was a fire shield where anytime he took damage, the attacker also took a bunch of damage.
And by DR, you mean damage resistance?
Oh, sorry, yeah, damage resistance. So he had like he resisted like 30 damage from every attack. So, you know, he was not taking a lot. And then he was healing at the beginning of every round as well. So they had to deal with those sacrifices first. They had to run around the map and they had to, you know, dodge through a bunch of bad terrain and worry about a bunch of other dudes. And meanwhile, he's knocking him in the head with a big mace and dropping him with one hit. And that meant, and then as soon as those were off, then they dumped meteors on his head. But it at least was, you know, a couple of rounds.
Right.
Where they were really worried about being able to even touch them, and that worked really well. So certainly in Paragon and Epic, you know, you need to have something to make sure that when they nuke your big bad evil guy, that your big bad evil guy isn't going to drop in one round, because this happened way too many times for me.
Mm-hmm.
And those checks for the skill challenge part, what type of action do you use for them?
I use miners. I started using, I forget who was it, I heard it on the DM expert panel, where they said, Greg Bilsender or somebody on there said that they use, and I think Chris Sims also brought this up, that he'll use standards with a lower DC and miners for a higher. And I was thinking about that. I was listening to that in the car, and I thought that one nice thing you could do is that you can use a miner, but it's risky. And like if you're disabling an arcane, you know, sigil, well, if you're going to do it with a miner, you're going to be rushing it. And if you're rushing it, you might take a bunch of feedback damage if you fail.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can still do a miner, but now there's a risk. It's not just I might fail. I'm more likely to fail. Now it's, but I'll hurt myself.
Right.
So
I think the example that they used was getting up from prone. You could do it as a move action, and you wouldn't provoke an opportunity attack. But if you did it as a miner,
provoke,
Yeah, in Caladriel's Revenge, there is a check you can do, and if you fail it, it causes you to lose a healing surge.
Yeah, my group just hates losing healing surges as a penalty, so I just started doing a bunch of damage to him instead, which is almost the same.
Well, this one was out of combat, this particular one, so there's not much you can do other than...
But you can still do a bunch of damage. You can do like 50 damage.
Yeah, and just tell them they can't heal.
Right, well, no, they can use the
healing surge.
So.
Yeah.
You know, they're still going to lose healing surges, but it just doesn't feel like losing healing surges.
I can see that now. Well, you failed that check. What is your healing surge value? Okay.
Yeah, right. You take a healing surge worth of damage. I've actually done that. Like, you know, you take 1/4 of your hit points of damage, and they're like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Wait.
So. Certain traps, that's actually not a bad way to lethalize your dungeon if that's becoming an issue. I easily would go with that. Oh yeah, 1/4, boom, you're done.
Oh yeah, or you can also just, you know, I have my little handy chart right here, and you can pick any level and just do a bunch of high limited damage to them, and it's going to be equally effective. And
exactly,
it's less random.
The new DM screen has the damage chart.
Right, right.
Yes,
mine's better, but yeah, that'll.
Well, yeah, but whatever. But it's on the like. Oh my god, that was so useful because I actually used it.
Yeah, I use it all the time. I use it in Gamma World.
Yeah, I used it in the game I ran. Because I didn't like the monsters I picked after I ran it the first time, so the second time I just came up with powers.
Yep.
Don't tell the players that. But
yes. You already have.
I know. But it worked out pretty well. I mean, I kept it pretty nice and easy. I just changed from... They had a lot of burst attacks, and I was like, you know what? I'd rather just hit one target, and that's what I did.
That question, by the way, was from John Tonegis, Johntonegis. The next question is from Amazing Triangle from Gainesville, Virginia, my state of Virginia. How can you make a Paragon adventure feel like it's not just a heroic adventure with better monsters?
Go ahead, Tracy.
I was just going to say it's the location. Oh, yeah, that's a big part of it.
My big one is set in the outer planes or the inner planes, some other plane.
Yeah, just not, you know, in the same old place, whether it's Shadowfell, Feywild, the outer planes, whatever. Yeah. Just change it.
Yeah, Shadowfell and Feywild. That's why I can't wait for the Shadowfell box set, because I did a bunch of adventuring in the Shadowfell, and it really gives you that feeling.
What were you going to say, Randall?
I was going to say that I would go off a little bit different from that. I think... setting might be okay, but to me, a unique reward as you go along. Maybe their first land holding or keep or whatever, some kind of really base of operations, notoriety. The actual player rewards, I think, can make a very rewarding Paragon campaign, as opposed to just, you know, sure, you could heap magic items on them, but that gets old. So it's like something unique that's theirs, or even one for each player. I mean, you know, maybe a player doesn't necessarily want a castle. Maybe he wants to live in a big hollow tree somewhere, you know, because he's a ranger or whatever. But, you know, some kind of unique reward like that, or an airship or something, you know.
And also changing the scale of the story itself. Like, a lot of the heroic stuff will be focused more on, you know, a town or something like that, where, you know, these could be saving an entire country. Rather than a smaller place.
Yep.
Yeah, that's true as well.
That was there's a few other questions, but I think those were the, you know, those are some real good ones for the group, so cool. We can pass on questions on the others.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else?
Trying to think what else. Everyone saw my very cool shelving unit that I have with all my stuff on it. Did you guys see those?
I have to go look.
View those pictures.
I saw your tweets, but I didn't look at the pictures because I was busy at work.
I did.
I have an original TSR shelving unit that I'm really proud of. So
wow.
But no, I was having to. I just had to move the shelves a bit around because I was having trouble getting to terrain and to my miniatures with one of my seating benches at the table in the way. So I just moved some stuff around this morning. And so when you're doing that, you clean stuff off and things like that. And so I stripped down the shelves and cleaned them. But not a big deal. But hey, you got to have your gaming space set like you want.
You mentioned me in one of I was looking at your old coffin things.
Yeah, those are her starts. Those are a mold. I recommend that mold if you want to do sarcophagi because they are really cool. The little mummy pieces fit inside the coffin.
Man, that shelving unit is pretty cool. Where'd you get that?
That's an old Walden. Which one? The big, the tall TSR one, or the one? The TSR one comes from Walden Books.
Wow.
That's way back, sweet. Like circa 1989.
Look at the monstrous compendiums. Do you remember those terrible things?
Oh, yeah.
Big three-ring binder. Oh, that was so awful.
I hated those. But
I grew
up
on that. That was my D&D, was with those freaking... And they had no demons because they were... Yeah, you know, you couldn't call them demons and devils, so they had Tanari and Bazu. And you're like, oh, come on.
That's right. In fact, you know what? They were talking about... Everyone's talking about, you know, various editions and stuff. And I was more upset from the change from first to second edition.
Oh,
not because of the rule changes, but because
of that. The bowing down to the masses.
Exactly, and I understand why, but it still does. It still makes, you know, it's weak.
Yeah. Well, I love that. Like Orcus is on the cover of the Monster Manual now. I'm like, yeah,
yeah, it's back where he belongs. Yeah, exactly.
Hey, so, did I hear that they're doing another Book of Vile Darkness?
I believe so.
Tell us about it.
I don't know much more. I thought
you know more. Tell us more.
Well, that's what the movie's based on, isn't it?
Oh yeah, I heard something about it. I wonder if do you think it's going to be like the third edition Book of Vile Darkness, or are they going to stay away from that?
I don't know.
That was awesome. And that book was shrink wrapped. You couldn't look at it in the store.
Yeah. So,
there's new pictures. They're like
mature
it has
audience in only.
It. Yeah.
Isn't
like, you know, you can read all the other D&D books with like, you know, people crushing in the skulls of other people with maces, but this one has boobs, so we're gonna put it in a shrink wrap.
Right. Yeah. Hey, I thought you said you didn't want to talk about that.
That's true. I'm sorry. Don't want to talk about the boobs.
Is Rob doing that one? Schwab?
I don't know.
I thought I heard that, but I'm not sure. I heard it mentioned, but they didn't really talk about it.
Yeah.
I don't know what's in it or what's going to be or anything like that.
Oh, cool.
I know they're filming. So, I mean, they're filming the movie in like the swamp or Louisiana or something.
Really?
Yeah, that's what I heard. I guess there's some kind of contest that you can be a guest. I mean, like have a walk-on role or something. I'm trying to remember now where I heard that. I don't know if that was on Wizard's site or if it was...
I don't have a lot of faith in a D&D movie.
Well, yeah. I have my opinions on... Well, I just need to write the script treatment. I mean, I know what D&D movie would actually do very well, but...
I know, but the producers don't. The producers
don't.
We need to sell it to the masses.
Yeah.
What would D&D be like for somebody who's never heard of D&D before?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I'll ask you guys, and then I'll give my own opinion. But what do you think? What property or whatever do you think would make a really good theater release D&D movie?
I'd like to see an animated feature of Dark Sun. Like, okay. Did you guys see Planet Hulk? So
there was a comic book
called Planet Hulk where the Hulk is shot off into space because he's too dangerous and he lands on this alien planet. And it's all full of monsters and he becomes a gladiator in the arena. And if you're thinking like if there was ever like a good role for the Hulk, it's as a gladiator.
Oh, you know? Wow.
So and he's on a and they're like as tough as he is. So he's actually having to fight. But It was a really good, they did a comic book of it, and then they did an adaptation, an animated adaptation that went straight to DVD, and it was pure. It was actually better than the comic in a lot of ways, because the ending of the comic wasn't very good, and they changed the ending in the show. And, you know, I mean, to me, when they're able to do an animated feature like that, they don't have to worry about selling a million of them to make their money back. Mm-hmm. You know, they can sell 10,000 and they can be as, you know, they can be as uncompromising as they want. And I'd love to see an uncompromising, you know, hardcore, like, do you remember the old Conan the Barbarian, the original Conan the Barbarian with Arnold?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, right. And it was, you know, lots of sex and lots of violence. And there was no
gritty.
Special effects were really low, right? There was hardly any special effects. And it's a great movie. I like it. A lot of people don't really like it, but you know, I think that's a good. That's like one of my favorite fantasy movies, and I'd love to see a Dark Sun done exactly that way, where it's uncompromising and it's R, and they can just do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Tracy?
I'm not sure. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe a Bron or something. That would be cool.
Maybe I didn't hear you.
Eberron or something, or
Eberron. Okay. So a steampunk kind of thing, maybe.
Yeah, Brown would be kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would like to see. I'm not sure if it would be the best choice for it, but it's certainly the one that I would like to see the most. I think I don't want to. I just don't want them to do something Realms or Dragonlance.
I could do with a Drizzt movie. I wouldn't be so upset with that.
I'd hate it. I'm so completely tired of hearing about that damn stupid dark elf. How many years has he been infesting
like
D&D
25
now? Yes, exactly. The majority of my life.
Tell us how you really feel. Don't hold it in like that.
Have you read Icewind Dale in a while?
God, it's been years since I've read
I reread it not too far back. And what I like about it is it's a 300-page book where there are two major wars, a fight with a dragon, a fight with a bunch of giants, a fight with a demon. They managed to pack, you know, more action into that 300-page book than most any other book. Like, look at, like, the Robert Jordan books where there's, like, 400 pages of them riding in a cart.
Oh,
right? And then you get the Icewind Dale. It's like they managed to change worlds in 300 pages. And it was like... the ultimate D&D book for me.
All right, let me qualify my statement. I liked the Icewind Dale series. I liked the prequel trilogy. I don't remember what it's called offhand.
Yeah.
And the next, I think, three books that came after that. So, like, the first nine books.
It's 10. Yeah, there was a four-book series was the one where the Dark Elves go to get him again.
Right, right. I liked those well enough. I think that even towards the end of that last four-book series, it was starting to drag on. And then the fact that it's kept going and going and going. I think it's not so much that I hate the idea or I really hate the character. I'm just – it's to me, it's so played out. It's part of, it's part of the reason that I hate Dro so much is I don't allow them in my campaigns at all. Not just as a player character, but I don't use them at all. They don't
exist. I like Dark Elves. Yeah.
I hate them. They're just so – they're so utterly played out for me that I just cannot stand them. So,
we found a hot button for Aaron. This is awesome.
Crystal Shard was 1988. So it's
guys,
23 years.
I was in the fifth edition. Dritz begins to sparkle.
Just telling. It did. I mean, it got way out of hand. I mean, like, and the problem was like he had all these little subchapters about how Drizzt felt, and you're like, man, I don't care.
Right.
Like, you know, there were two things you could count on in every, or three things you could count on in every Drizzt book. And it was like, you'd hear three pages about his footwork. You'd hear, you know, seven pages about him pontificating life as a drow. And then you'd hear about Wolfgar's rippling muscles. And you know, that was like, and it was like 15 books of that. But
I haven't read them. But yeah, I know well, guys, for me, if you want to make a D&D movie, first of all, you don't call it a D&D movie. You never mention D&D. You never mention the spells or things by name. And what you do is you go back to the original D&D book that was written by Andrea Norton back in 1976, 1975, Quag Keep. It's about players. It's about, and it's that they still have a crossover where it's players that become, that involve themselves in a world. They're modern people that they get trapped into a world, but they don't know it. So there are certain things in the book that let you know that they're sort of in a game, but it's done in an intelligent. Of course, Andrea Norton is one of the classic science fiction writers of all time, and fantasy writers. And I just think it would be really well done. You do it in that gritty fashion, like you were talking about with the Conan movies, with not a lot of fluff, you know. And I think it could be very well done. But you don't brand it a D&D movie. You name places that people will know who play D&D, know where they're at, because that book is set in the world of Greyhawk. But you don't talk about it, because that is what kill the movie.
I think you're actually really right there, because I think, I mean, even if people didn't have assumptions about D&D in the first place, people know how bad those first two D&D movies were. All right, the first one was hideous. The second one was, it wasn't the worst thing ever, but it wasn't good either. And just the brand association with movies alone is just grotesque.
Yeah. I just don't think that for a popular, if they want it to be a good movie, you're not going to be able to call it a D&D movie, because that's just, like you said, there's just too much, you know. I love the game, but you can't sell a movie that way. So, I mean, if you want to keep making it for the Sci-Fi Channel, sure. But
you know, I'm okay with like Sci-Fi Channel stuff, though. I hate Hollywood, so I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. Is Dean Cain going to star in it?
Whoever, sure.
Because really? Dean Cain is in every sci-fi movie.
I think like live action movies, I'm kind of done with them. I'm happy to do, you know, animated movies with, you know.
I think DC's done a really good job with their animated movies.
I haven't really seen any of those. They're on Netflix. They're now on Netflix on demand. I really want to watch them. But yeah, if you guys get a chance, check out Planet Hulk. It's really good. And it's a great primer for Dark Sun. You know, it's a really good, like, if you want to do like a Paragon or Epic tier Dark Sun game, that would be perfect.
That would be cool.
Well, guys, I'm going to call it a night.
Quick question for you, Mike. You don't like the 300 pages of the girls fawning over Rand?
Oh, God. I only read the first book. And, like, the first book was just Matt and Rand in a cart, miserable, raining, for, like, three-quarters of the book. And then, you know, what's funny is I read that, and then I read the George R. R. Martin books. Have you read those? Game of Thrones?
Haven't read them yet. But...
Oh, my God. They're hardcore. But they, I mean, like so much empires rising and falling and just tons of stuff happening. And it's hard to keep track of, but the books are awesome.
Except, is that going to be a series?
Yeah, TV? They're making an HBO series. And everyone's getting all excited because they're like, anytime there's a video clip of people riding on horses with the name Game of Thrones, they all immediately send it all over the place. You're like, what? It's dudes on horses. There's nothing that says Game of Thrones yet. But it's
yourselves, guys. Like, yeah, it's... Guys, I'm more
scared
for me.
Well, yeah, but the problem is, like, everyone's really excited because it's Game of Thrones, but it could have been anything.
Yeah, I don't care.
So, yeah, it's just so much more happens. The problem is that George R. R. Martin basically got a bunch of success and hasn't written anything since, and he's halfway in the story. Like, it ends on a complete cliffhanger, and there hasn't been another book for, like, 6 years. I mean, since Stephen King's Dark Tower series, I haven't felt so, you know, abandoned.
Well, Eddings did that too, didn't he? Wasn't there like a 5 or 6 year period where he did that, and it was like
not that I'm aware of.
For King, I think it was like 20 years.
Yeah, it was 10 ridiculous.
15 years. It was just nuts.
And the only reason he even picked it up again was he got that accident with the van, where the van hit him.
Yeah.
And he started to realize that if he didn't do it,
he's not going to do it. Yeah. Then of course he wrote the van accident into the story.
Yeah, it got really weird there.
I was not happy about that. But the rest of the book I loved. I still love that book. That book can do no wrong.
All right.
Good comic books of that, too. Marvel did a whole Dark Tower series of comics that are very good.
I read the first two. I haven't read the ones since then, so
yeah,
I need to do that.
Good stuff. All right, I'm heading out. Thank you, guys.
All right, Mike, always a pleasure.
Tracy, thank you for the help earlier.
You're welcome.
Talk to you guys later.
Take it easy.
I think we're pretty much done, mate.
Yeah, I think so.
So.
We can stop recording. We could keep chatting if you wanted to, but we're done recording.
I'll stop recording for now. Hey, Sam, you stop recording? Okay, fine.